Bonjour, chers collègues. Bienvenue à la formation professorale intitulée The New Gold Standard, Moving Towards Competency-Based Evaluations. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the workshop, faculty development workshop, entitled The New Gold Standard, Moving Towards Competency-Based Evaluation. I'm very pleased to see so many of you here today. And I'm particularly pleased that we have two invited speakers who will be with us. I think many of you perhaps already know Dr. David Tannenbaum, who's here from the University of Toronto. And this afternoon we'll be hearing from Dr. Timothy Allen, who is joining us from Saudi Arabia.
I've changed my clothes.
I'm going to remind people about the objectives that we have for the day, which you should have seen probably on the program for the workshop. They're listed behind me. And I'm going to just go over also the agenda for the day, because we're going to be in this room and also downstairs on the second floor. So for the first part of the morning, we're going to be in this room. Then we'll have a coffee break at about 10 o'clock, which will be just right outside the room here. We're all going to move downstairs during the coffee break, down three flights. There's elevators or stairs, and we'll be working in small groups for the rest of the morning. At about 12 o'clock, we come back up here for lunch. And the lunch will be for an hour from 12 to 1. At that point, we'll have another session here with Dr. Allen. And then we move back downstairs again for small groups for the second part of the afternoon. When we move down this afternoon, we need to take all our things with us because we will not be coming back to this room. For the morning, you're welcome to leave things here. We will be coming back up here afterwards. I have many people to thank for the development of this workshop, and I'm just going to put up a list of, that's only small groups. That's for later. Thank you. So, Dr. Tannenbaum, I want to thank you very much for coming and giving us a talk this morning. I will introduce you shortly. Dr. Allen, of course, also. We have an outstanding faculty development committee at McGill, and I'm just going to point out specifically Rob Primavesi, who has been working with me on developing this workshop, also Maureen Doyle, and Isabelle Leblanc, and Fanny Herson. They've all been an integral part of the development of this workshop. And we have some outstanding small group leaders today. Namta Gupta, Douglas Dalton, and Armand Alamian should be coming at some point. So I just want to say a big thank you to everyone. I do want to thank also Miriam Guaya, who is the former Director of Faculty Development in the Department of Family Medicine and has been a source of inspiration and guidance for me all year. And Andrea Zdib, who is my assistant, without whom nothing would actually happen, and she's outside. And I just want to say a big thank you to Andrea for making everything happen. So this morning we're going to start by hearing from Dr. Tannenbaum about CanMed's FM. Dr. Tannenbaum is in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Toronto and works at Mount Sinai Hospital. And he has the prestigious Donald Rice Lectureship from the Department, the College of Family Physicians of Canada for 2009 to 2011, more or less.
Yeah.
And so he's traveling around Canada in that context, speaking about CanMed's FM. And we're very happy that he will be speaking with us this morning. We have the session being taped, which will hopefully enable people who are not able to attend the session to see the session, at least, on the Family Medicine website. So don't be surprised if you see the camera pointing at you if you ask a question. But we want this to be an interactive session, and I encourage all of you to participate as much as you can to benefit from Dr. Tannenbaum's expertise. So over to you. Yes. What we'd like to do just to start the morning is just to have a tour de table, have people present themselves, just maybe say your name, where you work for the benefit of Dr. Tannenbaum, and if you're involved in the department or any particular roles that you have in your place of work. Nathalie, on va commencer avec toi.
Nathalie Boulanger, I work up north in Kujua. I've been working there for almost 20 years now, and I'm the chief of medicine there and the coordinator for the... I'm sorry. Un petit bout, j'ai pas parlé en anglais, moi.
OK.
Non, mais coordonnateur pour les stages de résidence.
I'm Miriam Boya, and I'm a physician at St. Mary's.
I'm Ivan Rohan, and I am a family physician, and I'm involved with the CME at the department.
I'm John Hughes. I'm a family physician at St. Mary's with a community practice and an abiding interest in medical informatics.
Daniel Squishman with CDC Quintanage.
Elena Rousseau, family physician, the rural program director for Gill.
Stéphanie Jainfa, I work as a family physician in palliative care at the MGH.
Doris Stig, I'm a family physician in Montreal and I'm involved with the CME committee at the Board of Health.
Gerald Anger, family physician in the community in St. Mary's and involved with the new nurse practitioner program.
I'm Heather Abrahams. I work at the Jewish Journal. I'm actually the resident education coordinator at the Jewish Journal.
I'm Susan Stanley, and I'm the family physician. I'm at St. Mary's.
I'm Lynn Lala. I'm also a family physician at St. Mary's. I'm the site coordinator for undergraduate education and family medicine. I work at ACME at the level of Quebec College.
Jim Chang, I'm family physician. I work at the Ritzel Family Practice Unit at the Jewish General Hospital, supervising residents.
I'm Heather Coombs. I'm an ER physician at St. Mary's.
So maybe we'll go in the back row. I know most of you got introduced, but we'll let you introduce yourselves again.
Armand Alanyan, I'm a family physician. I'm also the assistant in resident affairs at the Faculty of Medicine at McGill, with a particular interest in professionalism.
I'm Wayne Doyle, I'm the site director at St. Mary's for the Associate Community
Care. I'm speaking to the site director at Associate Community.
I'm Rob Kermadezi. I work in emergency at Marshall General Hospital Children's.
I'm Doug Dalton. I work at CLSC Metro and the University of Coast.
This side?
I'm a family. I coordinate the primary care and program at the Northern University.
Jim Allen. Alan Babylon, St. Mary's.
Fanny Grisanetary. I work in the community and at Herzl in Alexis.
It's a bit of long, I guess, for me, St. Mary's.
I'm not sure what you know, we can count as St. Mary's.
We have, as always, an excellent representation from St. Mary's.
Pretty impressive. Okay. So, well, thank you. Sure. Okay, well, thank you very, very much for inviting me. It's great to come home. This is my home, really, and I know many of you. So this is a real privilege to be here, and I think this should be fun. We'll try to make this an interactive session. We've got a little under, I guess, an hour and a quarter or so. So in that light, if you have questions, comments along the way, just jump in. Don't be shy. And we'll try to make this particularly useful for the circumstances that you're facing here. But I do want to bring you up to date on what's happening and what the work of the college has been. Tim and I have had many opportunities to speak together at various events at the college level, at FMEF, and other places to talk about the sort of the two sides of this issue of new developments around curriculum and evaluation. And one of the challenges will be to bring them together and figure out a way to utilize these two different initiatives that are starting to now become a little closer tied together. And we'll talk a bit about that. For main pro C purposes, I will declare no conflicts of interest. Let me tell you about the working group on curriculum review. Tim's group is the other group that's a working group on the certification process. Ours, which began about 3 years ago, was designed, was actually an initiative of the Section of Teachers Executives. That's who we report to. And it was to look at curriculum and what's been going on in curriculum. We've presented on a number of occasions, and we released an interim report at the program director's retreat a few weeks ago, and that is not yet on the website, but I hope it will be soon. So the purpose of this working group was to explore developments in medical education that need to be taken into account for family medicine,
and make some recommendations for change. It's a scheduled review, more or less. There hadn't been done one in about 15, one had not been done for about 15 years at the college level for postgrad. Family medicine, as you know, is changing. There's new models of interprofessional care. This has changed the role of family physician to some extent when you take that into account in education. Medical education in general has been changing internationally and moving towards competency-based work. And I don't know how many here would be familiar with competency-based education and what that's all about, where it's going. Some of you have some. So I'll talk about that because it's I don't know if it's a fad, but it's certainly the current trend. Some are worried that it's a fad. We can talk about that. There's some new expectations, changing expectations, and accountabilities from patients and society about what we should be producing within as graduates from our residency training programs. Program directors for many years have been asking for a better definition of the product of the residency training program, knowing exactly what residents need to, what skills they need to have acquired. The residents themselves want to know what the expectations are, but there's some changes that are happening in their work environment, particularly around contractual agreements, which has reduced work hours and created difficulty for us in trying to meet the demands of residency training and the full set of competencies that we're trying to have them achieve in the same two-year period. Family physicians in practice, and I know this is the case in Ontario, I don't know exactly the Quebec experience, but have become frustrated because graduates come to their communities and either don't have the full set of skills that they need, particularly in rural practice, or are not willing to practice comprehensive family medicine. Here's the makeup of the working group. It's program directors from across the country and others, number of residents, and Paul Rainsbury is on this committee. I mentioned that we've presented on a number of occasions. Here's a list of the various committees that we've presented to. So really just to show you that this has been disseminated fairly widely. There's been a lot of input into it. It's an iterative process. It's built upon itself, and it's been modified along the way. We've also presented internationally. AMI is an international conference in Europe in medical education. Wonka Europe was last year in Switzerland. We had an opportunity to present there. And there's a Brazilian family medicine conference when we suffered through that one as well. And at a number of universities, so having this Rice Award has given some funding to move around the country and present at various schools, so you can see lists of them. And Dal was last month, McGill, and then next week McMaster. So many schools have had faculty come to these kinds of sessions to hear about this and again, to provide input. It's been very helpful. CanMeds FM, which I'll talk about, and probably do most people know, have you seen CanMeds FM? Do you have any familiarity with it? Probably most of you have seen something. It's now posted on the website in both languages and available for your review. So the working group has come out with three key recommendations, and they're here. That residency training, the curriculum should be comprehensive, competency-based, and centered in family medicine. We call it the Triple C curriculum. These are not siloed areas or recommendations. They're really integrated, and I'll talk about how they are integrated. The first one around comprehensive care, and I'll ask you what you think about this, so just let me give you some thoughts. First, why comprehensive care? Why the full spectrum? It's probably not a question that we need to ask, but here's the answer if you think, if you're not certain about it. There's a lot in the literature now, Starfield in the States, who's talked about comprehensive family medicine as being the base of the healthcare system that produces better results than any other constructed health system. It's also somewhat of a reaction towards the trend towards focused practice, which I imagine is not much different in Quebec from Ontario, and we're seeing it across the country. And this notion of comprehensive family medicine through residency training has been stated by the college repeatedly. There's nothing new about this. It's around provincial identity, and it's meeting community needs. And when we talk about comprehensive care, we're talking about the standard domains of family medicine. It's what we're all trying to train our residents to do, common office and hospital problems, maternity care, end-of-life care, et cetera, and mental health emergency care down the line. So nothing is removed from the standard residency training program defined for family medicine when it was first put in place in the late 60s, I guess. It includes procedures as listed by the procedural working group, which is really an offshoot of your group, right, Tim? And excuse me, I'll turn this off. And there are some new competencies that here I've organized under some of the CanMed's roles. The collaborator role, collaborative practice skills, under the communicator role, use of the EMR, which I know may be a bit of a thorny issue here. The professional role, around professionalism, ethics, and boundaries. Under the manager role, patient safety initiatives, quality initiatives. It's going to be a big thing that residents need familiarity with. This is where we're going in family medicine and in primary care. The health advocate role around community and social responsibility. So just, I just wanted to ask if you have thoughts about this idea of comprehensive family medicine. Is this still feasible for us to be training residents in this way? And is this a proper definition for the scope of training? Any thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the clash of competency and comprehensiveness. Can one be competent and be comprehensive at the same time in a two-year program?
Yeah. Very good question. And I'll talk about that. And that's really what competence-based education is trying to look at. And it's about efficiencies in education. And it's taking control of the program. But it's still a real challenge. So, yeah, we'll talk about some of that. Other thoughts on this? Yeah.
Well, I could jump in to support a little bit what Heather just said. I think that if we're not comprehensive, we've lost the notion of family medicine. We have to be comprehensive. But I also think that the day of the two-year residency training program is long gone. Which
yeah.
We really missed it on that. We have to move forward in terms of changing how we train our students. But I really believe comprehensiveness is fundamental family medicine. We don't have that fundamental family medicine.
Is that the general consensus in the group? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the reality of practice is quite different. I mean, as a resident, you may practice comprehensive care because you're in that setting. But once you get out into practice, it's quite different.
Yeah, yeah.
Reality. So I think the residents see that dichotomy about what the ideal of family physician is and what even our governments and our society expect of us.
Right. And well, that brings up the question that we've heard from others is, well, which role models are you using that are actually demonstrating comprehensive care to your residents? And how serious are you about this? I mean, the answer to right now about that is that our training programs produce the so-called TOTI potential graduates who decide in practice what they're going to do. But we don't apologize for the fact that family medicine is broad-based and comprehensive, that we recognize that most people will not do the full scope of care, but you'll be permitted to go from residency to whichever areas of practice you choose to focus on or the community needs. But it's also been shown that if you don't train in certain areas, you're really very unlikely to go ahead and utilize those skills in practice or relearn them later. It doesn't seem to happen. Okay, Shalit, yeah.
I think it's also a little bit the changing face of medicine, because when I imagine how a family doctor might have been 50 years ago, you could probably do deliveries and do home visits, and the communities were smaller, and you could practice in all different spheres of family medicine, whereas now technology has advanced, the skills that are required have advanced. It's hard to be up to date in obstetrics and do home visits and do peds and do geriatrics when there's this volume of information in each of those spheres of family medicine, and to keep up with everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess my question is it realistic?
Well, I mean, what do people think about that? Yeah.
I think the standard of care is up. I can't get away with what I got away with when I was being trained. I mean, I just think about taking something off somebody's cornea, a different way of doing it. But I would say, in terms of the competency versus complete comprehensiveness, what I try to tell the residents is that, you know, you may not need to know about all the ways of managing prostate cancer, which I just did a lecture on, but your patients are going to come to you and ask about it. So you have to know something about it, at least how to find the right information.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a level you have to know right across the board.
The problem that we're facing in family medicine is also problems in the six-based specialties, where you know, being working in the rural, and we're trying to get, like, general internists, general pediatricians. We're not able to train them anymore because they're all worried about, I can't know everything in pediatrics, I can't know everything in internal medicine, so they all go into one,
right.
They all go into subspecialties, and basically we're teaching the students that to be good at something, you have to be subspecialist.
Hmm.
If you want to know your knowledge. So the problem is what we're doing in family medicine actually starts with the students.
George?
I'm looking at it from the other point of view because really I've been in practice outside the hospital settings forever. And what I find is that the need for the competency is coming from another angle. We cannot get consults. You know, every time I go to any kind of a lecture series where there are multiple specialists, versus a cardiologist, then it's a dermatologist, then it's a psychiatrist, the bottom line is, and now you too can do this. And everything that we used to consult for, we can't consult because we have no one to whom to consult.
Mm.
And all these tasks and the required knowledge, it keeps getting loaded from people we used to consult to down to us because we have nobody to ask. We have nobody to get another opinion from because there's nobody around, at least in Quebec. I don't know what it's like in Ontario. And so it's very onerous. And so I think it's coming at us from the request for consults and somewhere the two have to meet.
I think there's a lot of things I could say, but one of the things that is coming out and I think is very true is that a lot of practice is context-based. So really what happens is that if you don't prepare somebody in a family physician in a general way to be able to deal with the needs of the community, then they will never be able to pick up those skills. If you prepare them in a general way, they'll meet the needs of the community. So if in your community, for example, there's a need for somebody to practice obstetrics and you're trained in obstetrics, you can develop your skills in obstetrics and practice obstetrics. If in your community that's not a crime, you may actually drop your obstetrical skills,
yeah,
and not practice obstetrics and still be a good family physician. But I think that a lot of what we do is context-based, so whether it's the way in which people are given specific medical activities, the so-called AMPs, that do hospital work, they do something else, a lot of that is going to define what family physicians are going to do. So it's context-based.
Yeah.
But as educators, I think that we need to be preparing physicians who can meet the needs of the community. Therefore, we need to be preparing them in a broad way. I'd also say that I'm very excited about curriculum reform because I think that we need to move to the next level. You're going to talk to us about it. But I think that next level is much more about us taking control.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the issues in training is that when our residents go and get trained by obstetricians and gynecologists, say, we're going to give you a basic minimum, but ultimately you're going to be incompetent to do this unless you do extra training. It's really up to us to be able to define the curriculum in such a way that we've prepared our residents to be able to go on and do things. So those are a couple of thoughts,
yeah,
on this.
Okay, let's carry on. So the second main recommendation is about competence-based education, and I want to spend a bit of time on this because it's an area that's... There's a lot of confusion about this, and... It's an imprecise concept, and it has not been well implemented yet. So if you have some personal confusion about it, you know, join the club. Here's one definition of competence. So what are we aiming for at the end of the day? This is a complicated definition of it by one of the key authors in this area. I'll let you read this. Deliberate choices from a repertoire of behaviors for handling situations and tasks. Context issue comes up, knowledge, skills, judgment, attitudes, personal values with professional roles and responsibilities. This is Danielle Saussure's slide set that she put together for the program director's retreat. There's a couple of slides here on competence from her. And this graphically looks at some of the issues that are considered internal resources towards the development or establishment of competence. And the use of external resources, which we do when we're competent physicians, we know how to appropriately use external resources, consultants and patients and families, and getting at information within the professional and practice context utilizing the roles and responsibilities that we've developed as family physicians. And another way to look at competence is Miller's work. Some of you will be familiar with this. He talks about competence at four levels.
The base level is knowing. That's the knowledge piece that we start with when we learn about medicine. And from there, you progress to knowing how to do things. And you can describe them, that you can show others how to do them, and you can do them on simulation models. And ultimately, you can do it in the practical performance context of working with patients, the highest level. And so true competence is really at the doing level. At least that's how a lot of people describe it now. It's the performance, it's the idea of performance. It's much more than knowledge. It's the application of knowledge in the practice, the professional practice that we're involved with. So it's a complex kind of a thing. You pull together a whole lot of resources and cognitive skills, and you're very selective. Tim's work will talk about selectivity, which is this notion of really being able to determine at the moment, under the circumstances, what you bring forward to the patient and around diagnosis and management. That's probably not a fair definition, but I'll let you pick up on that. Yeah. Now, okay, so that's competence. Now, what about competency-based curriculum or competency-based education? So this is a little more down to what we need to think about. Here's one description. The current system, our traditional training, defines training by exposure to a clinical area for a specified period of time, the one-month rotation. In this case, we're talking adolescent medicine. Competency-based is a bit different. It focuses on what's the outcome desired here, the training outcome, and that drives the educational process. So we're talking about competence in the care of the adolescent patient, and you think of it in those terms, maybe you're not going to design it as a month of adolescent medicine. And think about other areas of clinical training that we currently do in rotation-based or time-based training, that if you focus more on outcomes, you might want to look at this quite differently. And I know you've already begun to develop that, because the horizontal program is underpinning the horizontal concepts is this notion of doing things a different way to get at outcomes, educational outcomes. So when you're talking about competency-based curriculum or education, you're designing a program that's competency-based, there are a few key ingredients, and this is what they are. You define the outcomes. What do you want the graduate to be able to do at the end of the program? Then develop your educational experiences accordingly and try to get off the notion of having to work within time constraints and rotation constraints. Not easy to do that, obviously. But that's an important step. And the program then is accountable for developing those educational experiences that will deliver the educational goods. Changes the accountability in competency-based to the program. That's a big issue, and not a well-accepted one necessarily. We can discuss that a bit, what it really means. And then you have to assess the competencies. So you have to have a program of assessment in place that measures resident performance along the way, that looks at benchmarks and performance indicators through the program so you can see that residents are progressing at a pace that they ought to. There will be a range, and we'll talk about that in a second, but still. There's monitoring, formative feedback, and what you'll hear from Tim is a robust formative feedback mechanism, program based on field notes and other means of feeding back to residents how they're doing so that they continue to develop their skills along the way. Define milestones and the opportunity to remediate people, or we probably shouldn't call it remediation in competency-based education. It just takes some people more time to reach the level of competence that we're expecting than others, and that needs to be built in. And our programs don't necessarily allow that. We don't have the funding to extend training easily. We have to work with funding bodies and ministries to look at how this can play out if we're serious about it. What does it mean for training? There's a lot about context in competency-based education, because where you place your residents is as important as what you try to teach them. It's about role modeling. It's about exposure to the kinds of problems that are relevant for practice. It's about integrating their skills, picking up skills on certain experiences and bringing them back to the family medicine context. And it's essential for professional socialization, understanding what it is to be a family physician. Now, I mentioned this big move internationally towards competency-based education. This is clear. Everything you read around educational developments in many fields, medicine is not alone, is about competence. And why? Because we're in an age of accountability. A lot of money goes into medical training, postgraduate training, the funders, government in our case, wants to see what we're producing, and is it meeting the demands of communities and society? We have expectations around public, around safety and quality of care, and that's part of this as well. But it's also about giving some clarity to learners and to teachers about what they're expected to learn. It shouldn't be, we have to get away from some of the vague kind of stuff that I think teachers feel when they're not certain what their responsibilities are towards residents. And this applies to a large extent to off-service supervisors and teachers who really don't quite know what our residents are expected to learn when they're with them. And we need to clarify that for people. It gives us this defined end product and a better sense of who's not meeting the benchmarks and outcomes that we can look at very specifically and measure. This chart compares them. I won't spend a whole lot of time on this, but traditional to competency-based. The traditional curriculum is to a large degree around developing knowledge and skills and attitudes on rotations. It's about what we want to teach people. In competency-based, it's about what the learner ought to achieve and demonstration of competence through action. It's knowledge application versus acquisition. It's teacher and learner versus teacher-centered education. And assessment is more with portfolios, accumulating. Portfolios are defined in different ways, but do you use portfolios here? Have you started to? Portfolio evaluation is a concept where you pull together a lot of information about what resident experiences have been, what they've achieved, what kind of feedback they've received, what work they've won, what they've done, what they've participated in, and what they've learned. And it's supposed to be reflective. There's a lot of self-assessment in the portfolio concept, and residents drive their learning. It's not so easy to put in practice. I don't know of any good portfolio systems right now. The assessment in competency-based is criterion-based versus norm-referenced. People understand the concepts? Some do, but... So, you know, traditionally when we evaluate a resident, we say, okay, this resident is pretty good. You know, most residents are 4 out of 5, right? And that's because they're pretty good relative to their peers and every other resident we've seen through the system and all the teaching we've done. So we, and that's our instinct, is to measure a resident's performance against the norm being other learners. In a competency-based system, you don't measure a learner against other learners. You measure them against the expected learning that that should have taken place. So you've got to measure what they've actually achieved and know that whether they have, in fact, achieved it. Now, our norm reference system is a faulty one. We halo people, right? We do that all the time. If they're really good at this, they're really good at everything. Or if they're poor, they're probably poor across the board. And people get labeled in that way with this halo effect. But it has relatively little to do with the specific competency acquisition, which we have a hard time measuring. Our systems are not well designed for that at all. Maybe in some procedural areas. Marion, go ahead. Let's hear that.
Theoretically, it sounds great. Okay, we're empowering the learners, and they're going to take charge of their learning and so on. But do we know, and I think the answer is no, but maybe you'd have some evidence about this, that it actually makes a qualitatively different family physician? Or is this just all about changing the language and the end product is the same? Because most of us in this room learned the traditional way. I did a month of adolescence, and then I took that knowledge and I applied it to my adolescence and my family practice. Seems fine. It worked for me. Why should it not work for everybody else now? So we're changing a lot of the way we talk about education and how we think about it, but is it really making any difference?
Anybody have an answer to that? I'll tell you what, yeah, go ahead.
I was talking to one of my friends the other day about this workshop, and he said, isn't it a novel concept that what were we evaluating if it wasn't competence,
right?
Yeah.
So I think there was a much larger subjective element, and you have this aspect of if the system works fine for the people who really are the sort of 4 out of 5s, but I think there are actual deficits in the 5 out of 5s that we're missing because we think that they're stellar. And competencies in the problem residents that we're also missing. So I think it's kind of a more comprehensive approach that identifies problems more regularly. I don't know if there's any data that proves that. So intuitively, this would suggest.
Yeah. And I think that most educators, when they think about competency-based concepts, it really makes sense. Of course we should be training to the goals of training. I mean, we have a sense of what people ought to achieve and what skill set they ought to have, and we should be training towards that endpoint. The application of it is where it's tricky, and the proof of its of this notion is not there. You're absolutely right. In fact, there is very little relevant data that we could turn to now to say that if we change our programs dramatically, we're going to see a different outcome. So we could stop now. Or
you know, it does seem to make sense. For all the education that we do, it would make sense that at the end of the two-year residency, when they send them off to their exams, we can say, well, you know what? We know that they've attained these competencies, and we know that when they finish their 2 years, that we've given them this exposition. What comes to mind as someone who's really involved with that educative process is resources to be able to do that. And also, what are the competencies? Like, you can break them down generally into pairing management and any other sort of scale that you want, but when we look very at the details of what those competencies are, who decides that? How do we standardize that across the nation or even internationally? Like, and these are the things that sort of start coming to mind.
Yeah. You've hit on all the big issues in the first few minutes here. And this is a huge issue. And this is about something that the theorists in this business, the educators, talk about granularity. What that means is that there are different levels of granularity when you're looking at defining competencies. So CanMeds FM, which we'll talk about in a minute, is high-level, not particularly granular, look at competency. If you start to get down to the fine learning objectives, and education, very specific educational outcomes, you're talking about a highly granular definition of competencies, and it becomes unwieldy because you can't test all those things, and you can't give... I'll tell you, we just went through an exercise at U of T 2 days ago where they developed a list of competencies for failing medicine residents. It's listed now at 711 items, divided by the main domains of practice. I'll get to that actually towards the end of this, the main domains of family medicine. And the exercise was designed to try to now cluster these things into something workable. We didn't get very far in that exercise, and I think it was a bit disappointing to people. But it brought up the idea of, like, what do you really do with this to make it workable? And there are some internationally, there are some working definitions and approaches to this, particularly in the Netherlands, where they're way ahead of us. And maybe some other places in Europe, like Denmark, where they're using CanMeds, and they're identifying different ways to define what the outcomes should be that are workable and measurable. I'll talk about that in a little while. But that's what we're struggling with now, and I can tell you that's what the Royal College has struggled with in their CanMeds project for over 10 years, and many other jurisdictions that are looking at competency-based. People know that they've got to achieve and insist on competency acquisition, but the mechanics of it are not clear. So if you don't, as I mentioned at the start, if you're not sure you really understand this, you're among the vast majority of people who don't quite understand where this is all going. And that's why I think your point is a good one. Without the proof, part of the reason the proof isn't there is because the programs haven't been well enough constructed for long enough to measure the outcomes. We're only starting to see that, and we will in the next few years, I think, but we're not ready yet on that. There are a couple of points.
Really trying to identify the outliers. We add technology skills. In the end, we 20 years ago, we had the book of objectives and what we expected the residents to acquire at the end. So this is really not new. I think I go by the definition of what competency, English language definition, is capable of doing whatever you're supposed to do. You're competent.
Yeah.
And if you're not competent, presumably you shouldn't practice medicine, and those are those individuals, the minority, the outliers, who have yet to acquire the skills to be a safe family physician.
Yeah. And I think at the highest level that is what it's all about. In an educational environment, we can take it a few steps down. We can say, you know, look, the classic example is obstetrics, and we all talk about that when we're talking about competency because it's a controversial area and it's And the training is variable across the country, and within university programs it's variable, and from resident to resident in a particular site it's variable. But if you look at that, because it's procedural, it's a little easier to look at. We know that not all of our residents come out of training programs competent to practice low-risk obstetrics. So, and the reasons for that are multiple. There are training sites that simply don't have the resources to do it, and they say, well, maybe that shouldn't be a mandated competency. And there are other reasons. Residents are not particularly interested. They say, I'm not going to do that in practice. I'd rather focus my time on something else. And we don't necessarily insist that they acquire the competency, because do we really measure it? Do you do simulated deliveries and stuff with your residents at the end to make sure that they've achieved competencies? Can they sew up an episiotomy because you have some simulator that will allow them to demonstrate that? Or have you observed every one of them and signed off that they can do it? I mean, most of us haven't. Most of us say, okay, you've done your 2 or 3 months of obstetrics or whatever the requirements are, and we think you've had a certain number of deliveries, and okay, well, that you're probably competent. And the resident says, I feel pretty good about this. I think I can do it. Or I do it to the level that I think I'm I need it. And that's the current method, but it's not a competency-based demonstration of achievement of skills. That's really where the dividing line is right now. And it's a question of how hard do we push that, and how practical is it to be measuring these things at that level? Yeah.
And how much time we have to train our residents, because achieving competence in obstetrics is one, but you want to achieve competence in every technique you have to do in the ER, and every technique you may have to do in ICU,
exactly.
And every technique you have to do.
And that's precisely where competency-based is on rocky ground, because when you take it to the limit of what this is all about, as Alan said, can't be done in 2 years. Maybe it takes 3 or 4. We don't really know. And do we have the resources and the ability to measure these things, to train at that level, to evaluate that level? And Tim will give us the answer to that later. We talk about a competency trajectory. This you know intuitively, I'm certain, that residents are either following the learning trajectory or they're falling off. And they're not meeting. These two divergent lines you can imagine as sort of the 5th and 95th percentile of residents' skill or performance. At the end of residency, residents should be at the beginning professional level. It's a term that's being used to define where they ought to be. They'll learn a lot more in the first few years of practice. They'll consolidate their skills, and then they'll be knowledgeable professionals at that point. And although this graph rises, you know that it levels off and in some cases declines over time for many of us. Yeah. So some of the concerns about competence-based education, it's reductionist. People then define competencies at the level that they can be measured and leave out the important big stuff, the professional role, the essentials of family medicine, the four principles, that kind of stuff. And as we talked about, it's a big shift. It takes a lot of resources and faculty development, assessment tools. And we heard from the residents when we presented to the section of residents at the college, we don't want to be experimented upon. Yeah. So you need a framework if you're going to develop a competency-based system. The framework is the organization, the categorization. We have the four principles, but it's not really a competency framework. It's been twisted into one for purposes of defining what should be in the Red Book and that sort of thing, but it's really not a competency framework, and it wasn't built that way. There are a number of frameworks around the world. Here's a few listed for family medicine in particular. And this is the CanMeds framework from the Royal College that was developed in the mid-90s and refined. The latest version is CanMeds 2005, and I think there's a newer version of it that'll be up in the next little while. CanMeds is very good. I mean, family medicine participated in its development, going back to the EFPO project, Educating Future Physicians for Ontario, which looked at what roles were expected of physicians by the public. And that's where CanMeds came from. It's recognized internationally. I mentioned in Europe there are countries that are using this as their competency framework. And in many undergraduate programs across the country, this is how they're structuring curriculum, right? I don't know what's happened. I think it's not quite that way here. But many programs are. And there's some benefit to harmonizing what's going on in family medicine with what goes on in the Royal College programs and undergrad to postgraduate to CME, which also in many cases is moving to CanMeds. The current designation for us in family medicine is CanMeds FM. So this is what we adopted. And we made some modifications to to some of the roles. So the medical expert role of CanMed's 2005 is the family medicine expert. It's actually very different. And if you get a chance to read it, I would encourage you to, because it speaks to what family medicine is all about, and you'll see the four principles have been well integrated into it. And we've modified Communicator quite a bit to take into account our roles and responsibilities with our patients that I think is unique to family medicine. The others, not very much in terms of modification. Some of you may have seen this diagram. We've improved on this. I'm going to show you in a minute, which links the four principles through the patient-centered clinical method to the CanMed's roles. And then we went to this graphic, which seemed a little too molecular. And then the current version. What do you think?
Love it. Just love it.
Thank you. Anyway, this is done by a graphic artist recently, and it's the current version of the design to demonstrate. This is a narrative, actually. This is the four principles working through the trunk of this tree, which is actually a representation of a family. Those are heads.
I have seen that.
Yeah, okay, so maybe it needs a little work still.
What's interesting is that you show this as the program for eggs, and then the two interpretations were eggs and kids, and it was quite. I saw eggs. A lot of people started. I think the suggestion was made to make a couple of them smaller, so it looked like a family.
Yeah, I could only do that. We changed those eggs from white to this kind of nebulous. Anyway, when you develop a framework, you design it in a certain way. The taxonomy for CanMeds is these three levels. CanMeds FM, four principles at the top that then inform these rules. And the roles are further divided into the key and enabling competencies, which you have, I think, in your handouts today. I'll quickly just run through them. The family medicine expert is an integrating role. It's about how do you do this all properly. And applying knowledge and skills, using the patient-centered method, dealing with complex problems, using procedural skills effectively, coordinating care, etc. The communicator role, you all understand, relationships, eliciting and synthesizing information and conveying it, developing common ground with patients, and this includes this EMR piece. The collaborator role is team-based care and working with communities, maintaining a positive working environment. That's a role, a leadership role, in fact, for family physicians, and engaging patients and families as participants. The manager role is looking at the healthcare system, but also managing practices and careers, resource utilization, and leadership roles. Health advocacy, again, is advocacy for patients and communities, determining the needs of communities and promoting health locally, globally. The scholar role is self-directed learning and critical appraisal, teaching and research for some. And then ultimately the professional role, which lots has been talked about, integrity, commitment to ethical practice, codes of practice, physician self-care, reflective practice, awareness of limits, self-assessment skills, that's all in the professional role. Is that clear? Reasonably clear on what the roles contain? What do you think about these roles? Are they a broad enough definition of what family medicine is about and what we do as family doctors, Doris?
I think it's a fantastic overview. Which then, you have this goal and you have to look backwards to see how you achieve the goal. But I think part of the difficulty, when you say residents don't want to be experimented on, part of the difficulty of putting it into practice, but the reality in Quebec, it can't happen. The reality in Quebec is that the graduating residents can't go into practice. They're so limited by restrictions on them, with the hours of the amps, with the need to do certain things in order to get a prem, that the residents that I see who are actually going to practice are limited to working in walk-ins, are limited to working 2 days a week in practice. You can't actually take all this stuff, be enthusiastic, when the structures that limit them are in place.
Is that the general feeling?
No. No, I think that you can work around it. I think the constraints are horrible. So I completely agree with Doris that the constraints are counterproductive and horrible. But I think that the opportunity is there to have a diversified practice if that's what you want to do.
It's hard to get away from the realities. But I think we're also talking about long term here, and you know, revamping education for the long term. We're looking at the next couple of decades here. Things may not look very good right now, but hopefully they're going to change because they have in other provinces. The move towards team based practices, which it happens to some extent in Quebec, and it's done very nicely in Ontario and other provinces, is a radical change for family medicine, and this fits beautifully in those models. Now, hopefully, they will be available to many who want them. They're expensive for governments to run, but it's what makes some of this, what you were talking about earlier, Marion, practical and workable. Yes, you can't know everything, but when you have a team that's on site, boy, you can do a lot more. If you have a pharmacist in your place, maybe some of you do, you know how much more you can do with that person available to you than you could manage without, and how much less consultation you actually do. Because they're so knowledgeable in the practical application of the use of medications in clinical practice and family medicine. So having teams around you really makes a difference. Now, that's really a lot of where we're going with this. It's not the only way to do it, and there are many different ways to work collaboratively with community resources. But I guess, encourage you to try not to get caught up with the current frustrations that you're dealing with, because we need to look a bit beyond that, too. There's a level below what we just spoke about, which is outcomes objectives for specific areas of learning. And I'm going to just take you quickly through what's going on at U of T as one example of this. And here we're talking about translating the competencies to curriculum. So this is now, we're looking at, so we understand a bit of competence-based education, the framework through CanMeds, and then now how do we create curriculum based on this? Here's a graphic that shows you, in summary form, the steps. Defining the educational outcomes, we've spoken about that. Developing the relevant learning opportunities through the academic program, clinical experiences, horizontal experiences, etc., using the appropriate resources and teaching modalities, and then running assessment throughout the process. So at U of T, what they've looked at, I mentioned the 711 items. They've identified competencies at four levels. And this is also some of this in literature as well, that you have to recognize that competency is not an all or none phenomenon. It's a gradation. And we continue to expand and improve upon our competencies in specific areas. So they've listed these four: resident readiness, coming out of medical school, what do we expect our first year residents to be able to do? An essential level of competency, all residents. Enriched, most residents should do this well. And then enhanced, which is what you might learn in a third-year program. So they've taken each one of the 711 and identified the four levels for them. And the 711 are clustered in these content areas, standard content areas of clinical practice and family. We're talking about largely the expert role and largely clinical areas, okay? And if you take an example of care of the elderly, one of the clinical areas, they've developed a set of content topics that define the competencies within this particular area of practice. And here are the ones that they've developed. And then under each one of those, they've got a set of competencies. So I'm going to just show you the example of one item from two of these content topics. So under cognitive assessment, here's one of the items. And you can see the gradation of expected skill development. Just have a quick look at that. And then under consent and capacity, another one of the items and how it's graded. So the question is, once you've, it's probably important for programs to go through thinking around this sort of thing. They constructed their topics against CanMeds and priority topics and key features and some other curriculum material that was available at U of T, but they tried to pull it all together to arrive at what the major topics were and then to define the specific competencies. The question, as I mentioned, is now what do you do with this? And how do you create curriculum from this? Some would say that if you go through the exercise and you've decided, and maybe we don't need to do this at every university, by the way. Queen's has done a nice job of listing them. There's an important mapping project going on at UBC, and there's this stuff out of U of T. I'm not sure that every school needs to recreate this thing. And some argue that this is a responsibility of the CFPC. Let's determine what the true expectations of competency are for family medicine education in Canada. After all, we have common accreditation, we have common expectations. Does everybody have to go through this very detailed, time-consuming exercise? I'm not sure. Some would say that the next step is then to just map your curriculum against these things. So you've defined the outcomes. That's what the 711 items are. Now let's look at curriculum. Where do these things exist, and are we covering them off? Now, that's a fairly simple way of assuring, in a way, that you've got a competency-based program. It doesn't necessarily change the structure of your program into what some think are more effective ways of learning, getting away from rotations and that kind of thing. But at least it helps you identify step one or step two that you're covering off the competency. You're giving residents an opportunity to learn them. The next step is assessment, and that's a tricky business. So this mapping, the mapping thing, which we talked about at the program director's retreat, is where schools are moving to next, is my thought about this. Questions about comments? Yeah.
I really think that the biggest challenge is the assessment piece, because I would suspect that if we took our list of educational objectives as it currently stands, it was probably around 700 items there, and they probably reflect these items. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would guess, you know.
They won't be far off, that's for sure.
You know, be able to do a full skate, a mocha. So in a sense, that exercise, I don't see it as being so different from listing these educational objectives. But the issue of demonstrating competency is really where it diverges. And so do we, in fact, you know, we assume that residents have learned to do capacity assessment, but we never really check. Mm. So,
yeah, I think you're right. Yep.
It's interesting in this movement towards assessing competency. It's moving more to like a pilot's model where you have these checklists and these log books, and you have to have acquired skills, and you log whenever you've done a certain procedure, and you have to collect experiences in all these areas. But the main problem is that the relationship between the teacher and the student pilot is much more intense, whereas to try and have a system that's moving this way where you just have, for instance, one supervisor and four learners, and you're having these very long checklists and never running simulations, it's very hard, because it'd be like, could you supervise four pilots flying at the same time with a checklist? You can't, right? Things like the mini mental, it's a very simple thing. But we don't have like a set day in a simulator where, sure enough, we make sure all the residents know how to do this. It might actually be useful. It's just very resource intense, like, to allocate a 6-hour day where you go to a simulation center. And you don't, these aren't fancy technical simulations often. It can be just running through standard communication skills, simple procedures. It's already moving in that direction, but we're very early, it seems.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, let's consider our residents as adult learners and let them take a greater role in terms of logging the skill sets that they acquire and their competencies. And I think not all residents, but most or average residents would be able to accurately say whether the skills you've developed and competency within a certain area or domain. We're still very much working on a model where, as teachers and supervisors, we're evaluating them.
that perhaps if we have the resident play a larger role in terms of in a sense of creating a portfolio of their competencies and then identifying those which are missing, it could be more doable as well.
Yeah, and if we can teach them to self-assess accurately, we'll be much further along in that regard. Yeah.
I think what I keep getting stuck on at a practical level is it's all nice to have this evaluative component, whether we assess them as competent or not. In my head, I keep thinking forward, and when you've identified the person who hasn't achieved that competency, we don't have the flexibility in our current training system to address that. And whether you're talking extra years or extra months or extra patient load, it doesn't exist. And it requires a lot of change on a moment's notice and providing different training to different residents because they don't acquire skills at the same rate.
Right.
I mean, they might have done their 25 deliveries, but be completely unable to do a delivery independently. And we know that they're not safe to do it. I mean, so it's not just time, right? We all know that
they learn
at very different rates and they need more practice. But I don't know, so it sounds lovely on paper, but if you remember, we also work in a system where there's service and education, and the people we depend upon also to teach our residents expect certain things from our residents when they're there. And they're not necessarily, it's not that our specialists don't know what to teach our residents, but they're also teaching them in the context of what they want from them. And they're not just there to teach them what we think they need to be competent in when they're done.
Like yes, absolutely.
There would be so much change required in order to get to this point.
And, you know, and the response to that is that nobody's expecting this to happen overnight. This is... this is probably a 10-year process, if we get there. But it's a major shift. People talk about this shift to competency-based education as the largest change in postgraduate in medical education since the Flexner changes of 1910. It's a century later that we're making some big shifts. So it's going to take time, and nobody's. So I don't think the accreditation team, when they visit here, when is it? In 2 years. Is going to expect radical change. But if you start... next week. If we start talking about competencies, if we start talking about trying to measure outcomes, if we start to use some of the materials and ideas that are coming out of Tim's group, we're going to be moving in the right direction. And that's what this is about. Yeah, the constraints in the system are massive and terribly complex. So it's not an overnight thing. Yeah?
I'm going to challenge the adult learner idea. But you still need the stick. You need to be able to beat people somewhere, whether you want their chance or react. We have a procedure log on 145 that we've had for a year now. A small minority of our residents are filling out that log, but there's no penalty for filling. So, you know, we need the assessment tools, but we also need to.
I agree. And we've been very lax in measuring competency. And people get away with a whole lot. And that's because, well, part of it is the nature of family medicine. People at the end of the day decide what they're going to do, so they learn to the level that they expect to need in practice. But this is a bit different. And you can imagine that in other specialties where there isn't quite as much flexibility in deciding what you're going to do once you leave, a surgeon has to have competency across a variety of surgical procedures, they're pushing this quite a bit harder than we have to date. There was a
point to make.
Just a basic question. From the same criteria. For instance, performing a normal vaginal delivery, I expect if you want it, can we subdivide that into all the things it takes?
Yeah.
Is it included, all the divisions of that in the 700, or is it one?
So I'm not sure about that, but... Well, it is. You're right, 700 is probably not that many when you think about the thousands of things that we need to be able to do to collapse it into the whole. I know the OB group has actually done a great deal of work refining and defining this very carefully and deciding at what level. And there's a lot of controversy about that. I probably shouldn't get into that right now. But, you know, what should residents be able to do beyond just saying that they can do a normal vaginal delivery? There's a lot more to it. So, yeah.
One other concern that I have is, for example, 20 years ago at McGill, it was kind of... Training could be extended if a resident wasn't deemed competent. And sometimes residents were in the system for years.
Yeah.
And you know, and then there was a sort of a much more formal process put in place, a promotions committee with a whole document that was elaborated, and many people now might think that Megillah's has gone really far in the other direction, where you know you can if you fail two rotations, you're on probation for a maximum number of months. If you fail on probation, you're out. So there's a defined limit, and I worry about the idea of, you know, allowing residents the time they need to reach the competencies. You also have to build in some
expectation of time.
Limits, I think, you know, or else we're going to be back to where we were, where it's endless. And it's not necessarily doing those learners a favor if they really aren't able. And we know that there are some residents.
Yeah, no, that's a good practical point about this as well. Okay.
Your competency changes with time through, in terms of benchmarks, in terms of what, first 6 months or 2 years, are we measuring competency in terms, I guess it gets into the evaluation, that it's a two-year program and you have 2 years to develop these competencies and we're measuring at the end of 2 years.
Right. So, but a lot of people talk about...
How is that working with promotion at the university level? And what happens in a two-year family medicine program versus a five-year Royal College program?
Some of the ideas around benchmarks are, and they're usually very high level. It's sort of, if we're looking at the family medicine experience, to what extent can residents work independently with patients? By the end of PGY1, they have to be able to, you know, independently assess the problem and come up with a management plan. These are very high level things. That takes direct observation, repeated sampling, and a general sense by experienced teachers that a resident has achieved a benchmark level of competence. And that's very different from the lower level competencies that we're talking around procedural issues, which is a separate matter. And many argue that in competency-based education, you really ought to be just sticking to the high level things, because you can't measure all the low level ones. You can sample them, and Tim will tell us about sampling.
That's a very important concept.
Yeah.
Back this afternoon, but I think it's a good thing to talk about.
Yeah. So in the assessment, we'll be sampling the acquisition of various competencies, and that's how examinations are built anyway. They just sample certain things. And from that, you infer, if residents meet an expected level on those sampled ones, you infer overall competence. And that's how it becomes a workable initiative, an approach.
If you compare Canada to the rest of the world, I mean, most of the family medicine programs are much longer. Do we have any data that people from Europe or people from other parts of the world are more competent because they extended the programs? We're packing more and more data into the shorter and shorter program.
Yeah.
And I never understood why endocrinologists need 5 years to learn two diseases, why we have to learn all diseases in 2 years. And if there is no money, maybe they should shorten the other specialist programs and make the medicine a little longer. But I'm just thinking now from the literature point of view and educational point of view, did we learn from other people because they have 3, 4, 5 year programs anywhere else?
No, they're not. There's no evidence that they're producing better family doctors. In fact, if you look at what their doctors are expected to do in family medicine, it's quite a bit less than what we do. It's rare for family doctors to do obstetrics, intrapartum obstetrics, anywhere in the world outside of North America. In hospital care, you know, the British system is now, they've moved to a 3 year family medicine program from whatever system they had before, which was really hard to describe. And they're now talking about expanding it to 4, even 5 years.
Right.
But it's to do no more than we learn in 2 years. And
we're
much smarter, and and we have more efficient training. And we've eliminated a lot of unnecessary, unproductive training experiences that were based on service. There's still some service requirement, of course, but we've removed a lot. And we still are seen as producing excellent family doctors. So it is hard to compare. It's hard to know why other... And the U.S. is very much talking about going to 4 years, largely because of the change in the contractual agreements that are cutting down their hours. So I don't have a good answer for that, except I guess we're just way better and much smarter. I'm going to go through a few more things quickly because we want to end off soon. We've talked about some of the
some of these things and portfolios and broad-based evaluation systems to look at competency acquisition, field notes, still ITERs in training evaluations, reports such as that they produce, like practice audits and academic project SUS presentations, 360 evaluations, and others. I won't touch on the evaluation side, which is Tim's work on evaluation objectives, priority topics, and key features, because we'll hear about that. And I will say that, just to reiterate, we're now still only talking about a 24-month program, with flexibility to extend for those who don't acquire the full set of competencies, but within limits. I think, Miriam, I think yours is a good point. I mean, there are residents who carry on forever, and we've all worked with them, and it's a real problem. And they usually are learning problems associated with that and other problems. But this is only about extending within a reasonable period. And I would think that most people should complete at most 3 years, in a three-year period, to what we're trying to achieve. So I don't think anybody's talking about much beyond that. But the other point about this is that residents not lose this comprehensive skill set if they're doing PGY3 programs. So the set of competencies across comprehensive family medicine needs to be retained. This is a recommendation now I'm talking about. It's not an accepted policy of the college. It is in most programs except for emergency medicine, which hasn't quite gotten there. And the last piece I want to touch on is that the curriculum be centered in family medicine. And what does that mean? It's about the learning environment being the essence of training, where you place residents, the people they work with, the patients they see, that's what it's all about. And it's about this, the medium is the message. And in here we're talking about the growth medium as a learner, not talking about the communication media. The message is very much in where we put our residents and how we structure the training and what we insist that they do. It's about family medicine competencies that we establish, and whether our residents are working with us or on off-service rotations, we've developed the objectives. We've decided what the competencies should be. And we take the pressure off our consultant teachers. We tell them, you know, you don't have to teach residents everything in your discipline. Here are the things we'd like you to focus on. And you know what? You only have to evaluate on these particular things. You don't have to evaluate the 7 CanMeds roles or even the 4 principles of family medicine. Just let us know if our residents have gained competency in these areas that we'd like to ask you to train them around. And the rest of it is our work. It's our business. Don't sweat it. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of the teachers in the Royal College program saying, I can't cover all this in this 3 weeks that you're giving me or month, but they always take off a week anyway. You know, it's the same everywhere. So, and this is really an opportunity to say, it's okay. Let's develop this together. Is this realistic? Can you offer this training? We'll deal with the rest. This is a 2-year program, and you're only looking at one snippet of it. That's all your responsibility is. Horizontal programs that you've initiated here are a very good way of teaching integrated methods of learning where you pull from other areas and bring it back to family medicine. It's all focused on what the needs are in family medicine. You'll pick up some learning there, but it'll always come back to here and the work with your patients and the ability to manage patients with continuity. This recommendation has been around a long time about family medicine-centered curriculum. It goes way back in college literature and accreditation recommendations, but it doesn't play out well necessarily. I'm just going to focus on one box in this slide, and it's this one on problem-solving approach, the third one down. And it talks about why things need to be centered in the discipline of learning that you're focusing on, and particularly in family medicine. So if all of our training were off-service in traditional hospital rotations, and many of the rotations, much of the learning still is in those environments, they learn to reduce uncertainty in diagnosis by ordering every imaginable test as quickly as possible and getting every consultation possible. They explore every possibility towards diagnosis, and they rule out every dangerous diagnosis that can come to mind. But the family medicine approach, as we all know, is completely different from that. It's about tolerating uncertainty, exploring probabilities, but ruling out dangerous things. Now, if you only learn in an environment, or primarily in an environment that teaches you what's on the left, how do you easily transition that to working with patients where the demands and expectations are completely different? That's the contextual concept around where you train and the kind of thinking and the professional socialization that we're talking about. So your move towards horizontal programming is, I think, the way to go. There are other ways to do this, and we don't insist and we don't recommend that everybody move to horizontal programming. As you've discovered, it's very hard to do, it's complex to organize, and not everyone's happy with it. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, okay. Family medicine-centered programs are around efficient programming, eliminating experiences that are not valid, bringing in those that are specific to acquiring competency in family medicine and the professional identity. And I don't need to define horizontal curriculum to you, but its goal really is to emphasize continuity of care, having residents fully involved in the management of their patients and being responsible for making decisions. And from that they learn a tremendous amount. I mean, I still get unsolicited from our residents in our horizontal program at my place saying, I can't believe there's another way to learn family medicine. If I didn't do it this way, I would not know how to be a family doctor. Now, why do people say that? I'm not sure. They don't really have a comparison. But these are spontaneous statements. So there's something in this notion of being fully responsible and assuming the role of family physician from day one that makes sense to learners. Don't ask me about outcome data. There isn't a lot. There's one study that we did that showed better preparation for practice. Yeah.
I actually have a... I don't know if your next slide is going to be proposed disadvantages, but are there any disadvantages to the horizontal curriculum? I'm being a bit devil's advocate here because I actually fully support horizontal curriculum, but is there some advantage to the learner to be spending a month with the surgeon and just doing all that surgical scut and developing a kind of relationship with the surgeon so that later when they're in practice they have some kind of professional relationship where they refer more easily? I guess I'm just wondering, are there disadvantages of taking our residents away from these kind of blasts of contact with specialists?
Yeah, so that's immersion learning and intensive learning in certain areas. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But that can't make up the whole program. So there are hybrid programs, and most programs are not pure horizontal. You know, the classic rotation is something like ICU, where if you pull residents out 3 days a week, forget it. They're so frustrated, and everyone, the learning doesn't take place. And the developers and supervisors on that experience become very aggravated, and they don't want to work with us. Well, that's not going to achieve anything. So you have to modify it under certain circumstances. But the overall goal is to increase exposure to family medicine, focus on continuity, and teaching by family physicians wherever possible. Wherever possible. So family physicians with focused practices in palliative medicine, in geriatrics, and emergency medicine, and everything else in patient care, who have a real sense of what family doctors do and know and understand the identity, make excellent teachers, and in many cases better teachers than subspecialists who are thinking on the left there. And that's really what we're talking about. But the responsibility for a group of patients and following those patients is a huge learning opportunity that's manifested well, not exclusively, but well in horizontal programming. Yeah, there are other disadvantages, for sure. It's a balance. And I'll tell you, though, that we, at our place, we began a horizontal program in 94, and it's still going pretty strong, and we've only minor modifications. So we pushed back a lot when residents said, no, we need more immersion time in this, that, and the other thing. And we said, you know what, hang on. Talk to us at the end of the two-year program. And by then, they figured it out. You know, it's very hard for them to feel that they can't learn it all in that one-month period, that it may actually take them 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months to acquire those competencies that otherwise would have been blasted in that month. But they do at the end learn them. And if they have to supplement it with a little bit of elective experience, so be it. there is just, can we go over by a few minutes, or how strict do you want to be?
Yeah, take your time.
In Belleville, Ontario, Jonathan Kerr, anybody know Jonathan? Jonathan's a rising star in family medicine education and practice. He's on our curriculum working group, and he works now at Queen's, but in the Belleville site, started up a practice there, and has attracted something like 20 family doctors to this community. Because everybody, he's a very charismatic guy, so he's managed to do this. And they're starting up a residency site there, which is purely non-rotational integrated family medicine. This is So the concept here is there's no such thing as rotations. You work as a family physician throughout your 2 years. You do all the things that family docs do, and you do it with family docs, and it's all integrated throughout your week. Your emergency room, your emergency medicine experiences may be, you know, 2-3 shifts a month for the 2 years, as an example. And I've asked him whether he thinks this is really going to work, because they're just starting it up. And there are some American programs that have experimented with this, and they've actually, there were a series of articles that came out about 8 or 9 years ago from the American programs that tried this, and they've had trouble demonstrating that it's better than the more traditional programming in the States. And you should know that, you know, our bold move towards horizontal programming has been, since its inception in residency and family medicine in the States, the standard way to train. That is, in the 3-year programs. First year, half day back. Second year, 2 half day backs or 3. And third year, 3 to 5 half days back with no block months in family medicine. So they've always had non-rotational horizontal type programming in the States. And yet you're mandated to do that.
Working for longitudinal integrated clerkships, so when third-year students are put out in rural communities as small as 5,000 inhabitants, very small communities, they acquire, they reach their goals faster than the ones in big cities, and they actually perform better on exams, and they get into the specialty of their choice as easily.
So that's an interesting model, and the data is coming out now in these integrated clerkships. So this is the similar concept. It's very hard to develop. I don't think that you could start from where you are now and move to this. So de novo programs might be able to do this. But anyway, just to let you know that there's some experimentation with this true, fully non-rotational, absolute family medicine only model of training. In implementation, so this is an important point that was expressed and insisted upon by the chairs of family medicine, that it's the college's responsibility to set standards, but not to define curriculum. Curriculum, how you run your program, learning experiences and the evaluation side, is a university matter, and it will look different across the 17 schools and site to site potentially. So you won't see dictated from the college a curriculum design. You may see at some point, when the policy people at the college get hold of the work, and that the standards are clear and they make it into the accreditation standards around competency-based education and the use of CAN meds. But it won't go much beyond that.
What we need, though, is defined outcomes that you mentioned at the beginning. That's what we need. So we had the defined outcomes.
Then you, So at a level that's more granular than CAN meds, but something that's workable. Yeah. And it's clear that the pace of change needs to be reasonable. I mentioned 10 years. You know, the track record of the college is pathetic in making changes in curriculum or insisting upon change. If the horizontal programming ideas appeared in a college document in 1995 when they talked about integrated family medicine training, and here we are 15 years later, and there's certainly no insistence that that be the model of training. In fact, you may get pushback when the accreditation team comes and, as happened here, starts counting the number of sessions of patient care and family medicine. So the only major change in residency training curriculum that was insisted upon by the college was that we go from, that we go to 8 months of family medicine, and that was, anybody remember, 1985, 88, that was it. And before that, I'm not even sure what was there. Maybe it was only 4 months that was required. And that was the only change that really made it into the accreditation guidelines. So for those who are panicking that this is going to happen tomorrow, forget it. It's an evolution. I think it's the way to go. We have to find out how to do it properly, and you should be moving in that direction. And whatever experimentation you can do in areas of training that you move towards competency-based will be very helpful to the whole process nationally. So I think that's what it's about now. Yeah.
Presented to the accreditors beforehand so that when the accreditation team comes along, they don't say, hey, you're doing this, and it's not. Like, how is the accreditation process being modified so that these changes can be integrated?
I can't speak for the accreditation committee. Louise Naismith is now the chair. I'll be talking to them in May. We've spoken to them regularly about this whole process. They're very much behind it. But they don't know at this point how it's going to translate into a new set of accreditation standards and a new Red Book. So there's talk about redesigning the Red Book over the next 2 to 3 years. So your external review in 2 years will likely be with the current Red Book and current requirements. That would be my guess. And if it's only changing, you know, if they get some new publication out in a year, they don't expect that someone who's accredited the following year is going to have put it in place. It just doesn't work that way. If you're moving in this direction, it's because you believe it's the way to go and you want to promote new models of education. It's not because of accreditation at this point. It will at some point. I think I'm going to stop because we talked about most of these things. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to remind people about the small groups. There will be coffee right outside the door here now. And for 10:30, I'd like people to be downstairs on the second floor in the Herbert Black area. You have in your folder an orange sheet with the list of small groups, and I'm just going to make a couple of minor changes based on some attendance issues. Stephanie, can you go in group 3 instead of group 4? And other people, Vanya, can you go in group 3 also? And Lenny, I told you group 1, right? And Ivan, I told you group 4. Perfect.
Thanks.
So downstairs on the second floor at 10:30, and we'll be back up here for lunch at 12 o'clock. So you can leave things here if you like. Thank you.